So welcome to the Go Health podcast. I am Gillian Strain. I'm Chief Exec of Go Health, an organization with a vision to enable churches and individual Christians to be a healing presence in the world. And you know, we do that all year round, but of course we are here in Advent, a time with particular pressures, but also perhaps a time where we can take a breath and seek new ways to be present with one another. So this is the fourth and final podcast in our season about burnout. And I'm super excited that my guest today is Jonathan Malazic, an essayist, journalist and scholar all the way through the gift of technology from America. Jonathan has experience of burnout and has written a book, which Amazon said in 2022 was their best book. So that's pretty good. And it's called The End of Burnout. Jonathan, welcome. It's fantastic that you're able to join us.
It's wonderful to be with you, Gillian.
So tell us a little bit more about why you wrote your book, The End of Burnout.
The book is the result of a initially fairly unfortunate collision of my intellectual or academic interests and my personal life. So I used to be a theology professor. I taught at a small college in Pennsylvania in the United States. And one thing I was really interested in that I taught about and I researched and wrote about was how our work raises these challenging moral and spiritual questions about meaning and vocation and cooperating with creation and all of those things. And I was very happy in that career for a while. And then at some point, things took a really bad turn for the worse, where I could barely get out of bed in the morning. And I just dreaded going to this job that I had dreamed of for years. I eventually quit that job. And in trying to make sense of my situation, I came across the concept of burnout, and I started to read more about it and get into the research of that. The book is the result of all of these threads coming together. So the new research on burnout, the old research on the meaning that we put into work, and my own experience and the experience of many other workers who've gone through something similar.
So can we like zoom in on that point? You'd got your dream job that you'd fantasize about. It's what you always wanted to do. What happened? What wasn't there enough of, or was there too much of something else? What was it about that led to the physical symptoms of burnout?
Yeah, the problem was a mismatch between my ideals for my work and the reality of my job. And that's really the classic definition of what burnout is. Our metaphor for burnout is right in the name. It's a burning. You know, we imagine that we have a quantity of energy that if we don't manage it well, we burn through it and then we are burned out. That's not really what the experience of burnout is like. It's more like trying to stretch across this gap between your ideals for work and the reality of your job. And when that gap grows and you have to stretch farther and farther to hold ideal and reality together, you undergo what we call burnout. And in my case, my ideals for the work of being a theology professor were sky high. You know, I thought that my work was going to totally fulfill my life. And no work can really do that. But the conditions in my work also became harder and harder to manage over time.
So it's like the picture you painted for yourself, or a picture that sort of says all your needs about who you are as a human aren't being met. So this is about our expectations are not being met. Is it that, or is it something else? So I'm training to be a coach, and the person today in my group, one of the girls said that she finds she works because work meets all her insecurities. So, right, she feels bad about herself, you know, but she can achieve at work and that makes her feel better about herself. So That seems to be two different things. Both, I think, are going to lead to burnout. So our ideals aren't met, or we find something in work that is perhaps a little unhealthy. I don't know.
Right. I think that it can happen from both directions. So, right, our ideals might be unrealistic. And I think that it is unrealistic to expect that work is going to meet all or even most of your human needs. At the same time, the conditions in which you work, as they get worse, they're going to depart from whatever ideals you have. So even if you have fairly modest ideals for work, if your schedule becomes harder to manage, if you are working harder but not getting sufficient reward, if there is unfairness in your workplace, all of those things can contribute to burnout from kind of the other side of that gap.
I am really curious about some of the theological or Christian spiritual roots to the causation around burnout. So I'm particularly thinking about the Protestant work ethic, right? And so like the tagline for the Protestant movement is salvation by faith, not by works. But I'm Scottish and, you know, I was brought up with really, really rigorous work ethic with theological roots. So how do we get into this muddle, and in what ways can you explain to us how our theology can cause a bit of burnout?
Right. And we in the US and Canada have very much inherited that work ethic from Great Britain. Yeah, it's this paradoxically, even though in Protestant theology, salvation is decidedly not by works. The classic analysis of this comes from the social theorist Max Weber. His contention was that, all right, so salvation is not up to me, it's up to God. There's nothing I can do to affect God's decision. But human beings want to know, like we want some kind of assurance. And so we go looking for that assurance. And we have found it, or we have tried to find it in the idea of labor in a calling. So the idea, according to Weber, Max Weber at least, is that to go looking for this assurance of our salvation, you know, the saints, the elect will participate in God's providential design for the world. And the way they do that is by laboring in wherever God has called them to be. So if you are called to be an accountant, or in, you know, John Calvin's time, if you are called to be a merchant or a farmer or something like that, your diligent labor in that calling can give you assurance. Well, I must be one of the elect. Look at how hard I'm working to bring God's providential design for the world into reality. And the interesting thing, I think, is that even as belief in that kind of theology has diminished in a more secular society, we still have that anxiety. We still have this anxiety about our worth.
Sure. So it sounds a bit like a new name for an old problem. Right today.
Right.
Because certainly with, I mean, vocation, having a calling to God, I do a lot of work with burnt out Christians, often burnt out clergy. And you can sense it in the room when you walk in, or the chat over coffee. You've just done four. Wish I only had four funerals to do. I've done 16 and somebody died during the funeral. I had to bury them. And it's like we're sort of trying, we've got this economic model of how to measure whether we're doing enough in our vocation. And it seems to be a whole, can seem to be a wholesale loss of faith, really, that God is with us in this, that we have to keep proving it all the time.
Right. And, you know, this is why the theological angle in the book starts from the idea that each of us is made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore has tremendous dignity. When, as soon as we're born, before we ever go to work, And if we never work, we still have that dignity. And my hope is that by believing a little bit more confidently in that dignity, then we don't need that same kind of sense of assurance. We know, well, wait a minute, I am loved. I am worthy. I don't have to prove it to myself.
Because so often work, I think, well, I think we can agree on both sides of the pond, is highly politicized, you know, in the UK, sort of this rhetoric of, you know, hardworking families need to be rewarded, and that's, you know, all the rest of it. So work then becomes something very different. It's proving that you're worthy in a way. So it seems like instead of just suggesting a few quick fixes, you're saying something quite revolutionary about work and what it is to be human.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that politics of rewarding good workers is very much a feature of the United States. And you hear U.S. politicians say all the time in both of the major parties, they talk about the dignity of work. And the idea there that, as they say, is that you have dignity if you work. So you have no dignity naturally. If you go and you work hard, then you get dignity. Of course, I already disagree, because I think that we have dignity before we ever work. But you end up seeing, you know, kind of like you said, that in order for that ideology of dignity, this idea that you only have dignity if you work, you end up having to make all kinds of exceptions. Oh, well, someone who's disabled, yeah, sure, they're fine. Someone who is retired, yeah, okay, you know, children under 18, all right, well, we'll make an exception for them too. And like, suddenly you're making so many exceptions that, you know, the whole ideology falls apart. Like, if you take the other approach and say, well, you have dignity whether or not you work, you don't have to make exceptions. Like, everybody's included.
Yeah. It's a big shift though, isn't it? I think in mindset. I remember when I was at home with little kids, you know, people would say, do you work or are you just at home with the kids? I want to say, blooming hell, I've never worked so hard in my life. It's a nightmare having young children. And when I had cancer when I was 21, and, you know, at that age, just finished my first degree, meet somebody who didn't know, what do you do? And you're like, oh, well, what do I say? If I say I've got cancer, that's going to make them feel super awkward, but I can't make anything up. Because, and from both experiences, I try now really hard. If I meet somebody new, I try not to have my opening questions, what do you do? I had experience of that being a really labeling thing and diminishing all the other stuff that was going on when I wasn't able to work for money.
Right. It's totally in our vocabulary, this assumption that any meritorious activity, whether it is, I mean, when it comes to illness, we often use a kind of military metaphors, you know, I'm fighting, I'm battling, you know, struggling, things like that. With raising families, it's usually the work metaphor. But we also talk about work. We work on our relationships. We say that marriage is work. Friendship is work. We say that mental health is hard work. We tell children that, you know, school is work. And, you know, pretty soon, like, all areas of life are work. And so there's just no escape. We can only value an activity if we think of it as work. And I think that that goes along with this bad mentality that a person only has value if they work. I think we need to expand our notion of what meaningful human activity is in order to break out of a burnout culture.
So are you also there for questioning some ideals around capitalism as well in working for money and this growth agenda we all seem to be swept up in, especially in Advent? You've got so much you've got to buy. So these are, this is big questions you're raising, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, and particularly the way that capitalist notions that, like you say, you know, well, more is always better.
Yeah.
Have infected our culture. You know, if we snapped our fingers and suddenly, you know, capitalism disappeared, I don't think burnout would necessarily disappear. I think that, you know, burnout is just a feature of whenever our ideals detach from reality. And I think that, you know, there are other modes of production that where those ideals and reality can depart.
Okay, so let's go to one of those places where you saw the ideals and reality maybe closer together, because I loved your stories. I want to exchange monk stories with you because I loved your experience in the monastery. And can you just tell the story again for the listeners? I'm thinking, I can't remember his name, but one of the fathers or monks you work with, and you asked about how do you stop work for the day. Can you tell that story again? Because I thought that was really interesting and important.
Right. Yeah. So this was a monk, Father Simeon, at a monastery in the southwestern deserts of the United States. It's a Benedictine Catholic monastery called the Monastery of Christ in the Desert. And it's very remote. Just to get there, you go off of the highway and drive 13 miles down an unpaved, very pitted, winding road that occasionally comes perilously close to, cliff's edge and it, down into a river.
Okay. You're painting a picture.
Right. And, you know, this monastery is located in this gorgeous canyon. So, you know, the monks are very much in some ways like the ideals of the desert fathers and mothers. Like, we're going to go out into the desert, get away from ordinary society, and then we'll be able to focus on what really matters to us, which is communal prayer. So the monks in this monastery try to live really closely to the 6th century rule of Saint Benedict. They pray as many times as Benedict prescribes. So they're in the chapel 5 or 6 hours a day, but they have to support themselves. So they do some work. They work 6 days a week for 3 or 4 hours a day and just in the morning. And I asked Father Simeon really about this anxiety. And Father Simeon had been a defense attorney. You know, he knows about the world of work and burnout. And yeah, I mean, he said, well, you know, when the work period is done, if you feel like your work is not quite finished, like, you just get over it. And he said that it's not easy for monks to do that, especially when they're young. They want to prove themselves. They still have that worldly thinking. And it occurs to me that, you know, getting over it is an important spiritual discipline.
So just to be clear, getting over it, getting over your attachment to having to finish or your work's going to give all the meaning you can get. You just got to get over it. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Your work will be there the next day. I think about the brief little sermon Jesus gives about the birds of the air and the lilies of the field. Like, they don't worry. You know, they know that, there will be enough. They will be provided for. And like, why are you worried? You know, aren't you worth even more than them? Yeah, the work will be there. Don't worry. There's something else to do right now that's more important.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you'd have to know what is more important. You know, so you need to have a concept of yourself outside of work. But I was really struck by that, you know. I mean, I wasn't there, obviously, but they kind of get over it. I mean, that's difficult. That's hard. But of all the stuff I've read around burnout, and I read a lot of time management books and, you know, how to work, because I juggle family and all sorts. I love that because it was so clear. It's like a slap in the face. Get over it. Who do you think you are? You're about God's work. You know, you just get to join in for a little bit. It really struck me.
I also like to think about that in terms of another book that I love, that I'm sure that many listeners are familiar with is the English journalist Oliver Berkman's book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And it's a very similar message as Father Simeon has. You know, you have a limited number of years, weeks, hours, minutes on Earth. You have limited attention. You have limited ability to, well, you're very limited physically. You can only be in one place at a time. And Berkman wants us to have, like radically accept that limitation. We are finite. We are, our desires will always outstrip our ability to fulfill them. And the only way to live kind of in a sane and sensible way is to become okay with having some of those ideals and desires unfulfilled, become okay with letting some people down, and, you know, recognizing that it's not up to you to fulfill everything that everybody demands of you, because it's probably impossible.
Mm. I think there's something also around fulfilling your potential that can, I don't know, lead to stress. So here's my, can I tell you my monk story?
Yeah, please.
So I heard this story when I was training to be a clergy person, we had to go as time management for clergy or whatever. I thought it was going to be all about how you manage your diary and to-do lists and, you know, whatever it was. But we had this really interesting guy who was a psychologist, psychotherapist, but also a priest. And he told the story, and I've never forgot it because I think he says something important. He said, right, imagine this. You're in the monastery and you're a monk or a nun, and your job is to pull the turnips. So you're working your way along the row of turnips and you're pulling them out one by one. And just as you're pulling out the penultimate turnip, the bell goes and it's time to go and pray, right? So what do? Now, every single bit of me, maybe I've changed my mind a bit now, but I was like, pure Protestant work ethic. You pull out the last turnip. What do you mean? What do? You're there. But that's the wrong answer. You go and pray because that's a bigger thing to do. But as he explained it, he's also said, you know, and I'd like to know what you think about this. He said the reason you don't pull out the last turnip is that you don't know when you're going to die. And some of our anxiety about work and how to live and fulfilling our potential, our anxiety is rooted in the fact we don't know how much time we have. So if we live and work according to task, we'll always be anxious because we'll never know if we're going to finish. But if you live and work according to time, the right thing to do in that moment, then you will live at a sort of psychological or existential place that is less anxious.
Yeah. So this is another thing in Benedict's rule, keep death daily before your eyes. Always remember that you will die. Your time is limited. And I think that, you know, Berkman is, you know, not, he's not writing from a religious perspective, but there's so much wisdom in what he is saying in, yeah, I mean, recognizing that your life will end with undone tasks. There will be things on your to-do list. And you know, we're forced to become okay with that. I mean, we have no choice. I think that's the thing. It's like, you can't just, you have to be okay with it.
Get over it.
Right?
It's really interesting. I want to kind of shift towards solutions is too light a word, but right. You've talked really beautifully about some of the roots of burnout behavior within religious and theology, right? Protestant work ethic. But let's look at the good stuff in our theology and our spiritual tradition that can help us. Particularly struck by your word dignity and by the word divinity, remember. So when I was reading it, I don't know why, but in my head, I don't know in your tradition, in my sort of high Anglican tradition, on Ash Wednesday, you go to church and they draw a big ash cross on your head. They go, remember, thou art dust, and to dust thou shalt return. And I kind of feel like we need an alternative ritual that says, thou art divine and dignity, and you must remember that. Can you speak a little bit to these roots? And if we're going to get over it, what better frameworks can you offer us?
Right, yeah. And I think, it has to start with, yeah, dignity and, you know, seeing that image of God in ourselves and in others. My burnout is connected to yours, or it's connected to the other people that I interact with day to day. And it's not even just like when I'm at work, like when I go into a shop and I'm a demanding, unreasonable customer, that is affecting the working conditions of someone else. If I am an unreasonable parishioner, for example.
Can't imagine that ever happening.
Right. No. Totally hypothetically. But, you know, that's going to contribute to clergy burnout. And, you know, if you're in the position of someone whose job entails a kind of service, you know, you don't want to come out to your students or clients or parishioners and say, you're the problem. But, I mean, the reality is that, I mean, of course, you know, the people that you work with and the people you're trying to serve are contributing to the problem. You can't really say that out loud, but we have to take responsibility for each other's ideals and conditions and potential burnout. And theologically, I think that, you know, the way to think about that could be, you know, the body of Christ, that each of us is a member. And, you know, if one suffers, the whole body suffers. And so, you know, I may not be the hand, but I need to care about the hand so that the whole body can be healthy.
So I hear that's a thing that's so light. You know, we can apply that to ourselves and ask ourselves questions about how we plan our day and all the rest of it. And it's maybe great if you live in a monastery and, you know, we've got St. Benedict and hundreds of years. We're pretty sure about the system there. What if the system that we're living in is counter to that, to living a healthy life with the dignity and divinity that we respect? Is it just about survival and changing how I think about the system I'm in and saying, get over it at the end of the day? Or is there a larger political question about challenging the systems as much as we're able to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have to challenge the systems, and I think that we need to recognize that these systems are human constructs. It very often feels like political systems, economic systems, modes of production in workplaces, and so on are irreformable. They're just these colossal facts of our existence that kind of press down on us. But all of those systems were made by human beings. And so it might be difficult to remake them or to modify them, but it's not impossible. You know, and so maybe another thing that we need to get over is, in some respects, perhaps we need to get over our sense that we owe these systems something. You know, we can reform them. Like the people who made those systems, we may want to honor them in some respects, but they're not here anymore. We're the ones who are in control. We have the power to remake our workplaces, to remake our churches and hospitals and, you know, ultimately even our government systems. You know, it's hard and we probably can't totally remake them, but we can move things in a direction where people's dignity is respected.
Almost feels like there is what's the right word? That we must in some way, because if we don't challenge systems that, and if we have the, if we're in a privileged position to be able to challenge systems, then not doing it wouldn't be respecting our understanding of ourselves as divine and are made in the image of God. It's just putting up with crap if we don't, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So we're in Advent, and I'm just curious about all the work you've done around how to manage work and to recalibrate, I guess, your sense of worth as a human being. Can you give us any advice or top tips around how to have a good Advent? We're particularly thinking about, so our Advent season is called Waiting Well. So how do we wait well for the birth of Christ? We don't really do the four last things, kind of take a more positive twist on it. But so we're asking, how can we wait well with presence? You can see the dual use of the word there. Any advice you can give us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what Advent culminates in is, you know, the incarnation, God becoming human. So it's like, if you did not get the message that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, here it is again in kind of, you know, more radical and concrete form. Human beings are so worth saving that God will become one of us in order to make that happen. So I think that Advent is a great time to think about human dignity, your own human dignity and the dignity of those around you. That could be through almsgiving, prayer, things like that. But yeah, recognizing that each of us has this unbelievable worth, a worth that we have a hard time accepting, which is, it's kind of shocking that like our value is least visible to ourselves. And Advent, Christmas is, a radical confrontation with that.
Jonathan, thank you so much. We're actually going to be picking up this conversation over in the Go Health community as we go through Advent together. Our theme is Waiting Well with Presence. I'd love to know what you thought about what we've been discussing here on the Go Health podcast. Advent Journey is available for all our Go Health community members. Thank you to Rosie Dawson for our producing this podcast, and to Wendy Lloyd from the Go Health team for all her work on this series and this podcast. Please do hit share and let others know about our work and this podcast. I'd love for as many people as possible to hear it as we together seek to flourish and be that thing, right? Healing presences in the world today. We need that right now and going into next year as well. Jonathan, thank you once again for being on the Go Health podcast.
Thank you, Jillian. It was a real pleasure.
It's been lovely chatting with you.